This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott, and you can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Avir Mitra is a doctor training as an emergency room specialist in New York City. And a while back, he met a patient at his hospital, a young man from Jamaica. And that man told him a story that has had a big impact on Avir and how he practices medicine. So he wanted to introduce that man to us.
Meet Malcolm. He was living in Jamaica in 2012. And on this particular night, he was heading home from work in a shared taxi with a bunch of strangers.
Apparently, there was somebody in a taxi who wanted to rob the car or something.
The man pulled out a gun. He ordered everyone out of the car.
Now, when I got out of the car, all of his attention now started to focus on me. He left everybody else. He had the gun on me because when I walked out, he realized that I was gay. He immediately pointed the gun at me and said, and then he just like, I didn't know a fish was in here.
Fish is a derogatory term used to harass and insult gay men. Malcolm says he's worried this story could make his family in Jamaica unsafe, so he asked that we don't use his real name. He's in his mid-20s now, but let's step back, rewind all the way back to his childhood in a small town in St. Anne Parish. Malcolm says everyone knew everyone in his town, and everyone knew he was gay.
I talked very squeaky, for example. Like some would say you talk like a girl. The way how I walk, I would look at other boys my age like, I don't look like that. And it's sort of wishing to be normal.
Being Malcolm's kind of different, though, is tough in Jamaica, says Sarah Hamilton. She's a human rights lawyer for Amnesty International.
And I am Jamaican myself. Jamaica is a deeply religious and Christian country. And I think 70% of Jamaicans identify as evangelical Christian. There's widespread belief that homosexuality is actually against the laws of God and is seen as a threat to their religion. And as a threat to religion, it's a threat to their identity.
Malcolm says as a boy, strangers in the street would hiss threatening words at him. In school, he was bullied. He told his teachers at first, but eventually stopped complaining because no one helped. He felt afraid. He had nightmares. Even the dance hall music that was popular when Malcolm was a teenager was full of homophobic slurs.
My dogs set rules, set laws.
It's very normal for you to go to a session, like a dance or whatever, and people will be, like, they have these aerosol cans, and they will use a lighter, and they will spray the fire out when these songs come on, because that's a symbol that people who are gay needs to be burned. Name calling, people saying like, people like you must die, you don't deserve to live.
And it wasn't empty talk. One evening, Malcolm was walking home from classes and he was attacked by a group of men.
They did a number on me, they beat me really bad. They dragged me into the little alley and they were calling me names, going on and on and on. They punched me, they kicked me on the ground, they beat me really bad.
So he did what most of us would do.
I went to the police station and I told them what happened. And the cop, he looked at me and said, that is what you deserve. That's exactly what he said to me. And I went into a public restroom and I cleaned myself up and then I went home.
At that moment, Malcolm realized the police wouldn't protect him. No one was going to protect him.
Even if somebody tries to stand up for you, then they go against that person. They're like, oh, you're trying to protect this gay man from us. Are you gay too?
In fact, anti-gay prejudice is written into Jamaican law. A colonial era rule criminalizes male intercourse. And LGBT activists say talk of jail time and prison is used to intimidate people. And then in 2006, a Time magazine headline asked if Jamaica was maybe the most homophobic place on earth. Writer and activist Suzanne Persard keeps tabs on Jamaica.
So I'm a queer Jamaican American woman. Yeah, I'm actually a kid from, of Jamaican parents. I was born and raised in New York City, and my parents are from Kingston.
The country's track record of homophobic violence is clear, but Persard says it's also time to update Jamaica's image. When activists held the country's first public pride celebration in 2015, the Minister of Justice urged Jamaicans to respect the event.
You have more people coming out, and, you know, various organizations are coming out in support of, you know, LGBT rights as a basic tenet of human rights. A lot of LGBT activism on the ground has been happening, and that's definitely something that I think a lot of people are surprised to learn about, you know, given the media portrayals of Jamaica as this country that has machete-wielding mobs.
So Jamaica's story has evolved, but Malcolm, who was bullied as a boy and taunted as a teen, says as he grew older, Jamaica got worse for him. Fast forward a couple years, and Malcolm is where we met him at the top of this story, with a gun to his head, singled out for being gay.
He put the gun in my face, and I was trying to get away. And I'm not really entirely sure what happened after that. He gun-butted me, and then he shot me.
Knocked unconscious and bleeding from his leg, Malcolm eventually came to, lying on the side of the street. He spent several weeks recovering from the gunshot wound and a brain injury. Depressed, he felt he might take his own life, or eventually someone else would. So Malcolm left Jamaica. He used a tourist visa to travel to the United States, but he actually had no intention of returning. Little money, no job, he arrived in New York City. Specifically, Elmhurst, Queens. Walking out of the subway, it seems like everyone is speaking a different language here. A Spanish bodega butts up against a Korean grocery store, which is filled with Bengalis. I'm a new doctor, and I'm doing part of my residency in Queens, and that's where I met Malcolm. At first, he was reserved and nervous. It took a while, but eventually he opened up and told me just how scary it was for him growing up in Jamaica.
It's constant, it's every day, and it's been a nightmare for the entire 20 odd years. I don't know what it is to live.
Denali Fernando introduced us. She's one of my supervising doctors in the emergency department. And Elmhurst Hospital, where we work, cares for lots of people who are new to America. A lot of people just like Malcolm, who are undocumented.
Uninsured, underinsured, and so they end up utilizing the ED as their primary source of entry into the healthcare systems, the portal of entry.
Hospital leaders wanted to know more about the immigrants who came through the ER, so they surveyed 500 patients and asked two questions.
Were you ever threatened or harmed by groups such as the government, police, military, or rebel soldiers? And the second question was, some people in your situation have experienced torture. Has this ever happened to you or your family?
Nearly 7% of the patients said yes, they had experienced some form of torture. That may sound small, but our ER has 90,000 patient visits every year.
You know, I just did a shift in that ER today. That means at least one or two of those people that were in the ER today
could well have been tortured by them. Yep.
When the doctors realized that, they started work on a project that later became the Libertas Center for Human Rights. It's an ER-based program, and Denali Fernando is the current medical director. Eventually, Malcolm made his way to their offices, tucked away in a quiet old part of the hospital.
Yes.
At Libertas, he learned he wasn't just a victim of a hate crime.
Okay, great. I'm planning on meeting with the billing department.
Remember when Malcolm spoke to his teachers, when he went to the police? Malcolm says they looked the other way, and at least in one instance, authorities condoned violence against him. Dr. Fernando says Malcolm's experiences make him a torture survivor, according to the United Nations and United States definitions.
If there are no systems in place to protect you, or the systems that are in place don't offer protection, then you will qualify.
The center links asylum seekers with medical care, counseling, and a caseworker. The plan is to help Malcolm get well as he works to gain legal status in the U.S. It's a long, winding process that means talking with attorneys and sharing ugly details from the past. Dr. Fernando did a forensic evaluation of Malcolm, a medical and psychological exam, and later wrote an affidavit to support his asylum case.
The case for asylum is that you cannot return to your home country because if you go, your life will be in danger.
The Libertas Center is studying the people it serves and their interactions with our healthcare system.
But the most interesting piece of data, I think, 72% of these patients never had a physician ask them about their torture.
In medicine, they say you'll only find something if you're looking for it. And doctors like me simply weren't looking. We weren't asking the right questions.
I mean, I've never asked anyone about... I wouldn't even know how to ask that. That just seems very... like, weird. Like, how do you go up to someone that's, oh, so are you tortured? Like, I can imagine a lot of people be like, what are you talking about? Like,
yeah.
No.
So, you know, I think part of it is just to weave it into your conversation. And so if they say they're from a country where you know it's a country where there's a lot of political turmoil and harm, that can be something to kind of initiate the conversation. And then when you're doing the physical exam on the patient, if you see scars, you can ask them, oh, I see these scars, what is this from?
Well, now I'm on the lookout. There are centers like Libertas at Bellevue Hospital in New York City, another in Minneapolis, and about 30 other places across the country. Malcolm's asylum papers have been filed, but it can take 3 or 4 years before you get a hearing before a judge. Until then, Malcolm's living in legal limbo, waiting his turn.
This is my home, so I can't picture myself living anywhere else right now.
Physician Avir Mitra reported this story with help from Alex Stern. Avir is completing training as an ER specialist in New York City. Let's continue this conversation about seeking refuge and coming to this country online. You can reach us on Twitter. We are at WHYYThePulse, and we've been using the hashtag #SeekingRefuge. Tell us your stories.